Call the case of United States versus Joseph Camerata, 23-2110. Good morning, Mr. Goldberger.
Sentencing imposed 10 years term and a $250,000 fine, along with restitution of $31 million and a forfeiture of about $16.5 million.
Mr. Goldberger, yeah. This is, at least in my experience, a really unusual case, especially for somebody who's a class action groupie, because I've never seen a criminal case converge in some respect with the provisions of Rule 23 in the Rules of Civil Procedure. And of course, restitution is an issue here, as is a question of loss. And they were not simple to resolve, but they're what we are resolving within a criminal proceeding with these various class action proceedings out there and the settlements that have been reached. I would like to start out by, and in fact, I will assert and see whether you agree or disagree, that it was the class as an entity, as that unusual creation that Judge Posner called an ingenious procedural device, that experienced the loss here. Not individuals, because what existed at the time these fraudulent claims were made, the class was in existence and the claims were made against the class, or from the claims were made to the class.
The government's theory, which the judge adopted, was that because the class, and I'm very glad you looked at it in this perspective. The class gets a pot of money,
right?
And the money
as a result,
the pot does not get larger or smaller based on how many people make claims for to participate in the settlement.
Well, it actually is affected by the number of people. I mean, if most of these had to be 23B3 actions, which afford to members of the class a right to opt out. In fact, the rule was amended and they have two points where they can opt out.
Yes.
So the extent to which a number of people opt out to either pursue their own claims or they just don't, as a matter of principle, want to be part of this, that still is going to affect downstream who gets what. But if the class as an entity is the victim, that's a fixed amount of money fixed by the
settlement. That's my point. And the finding by the district court was each pot of money from each of the class actions that we're talking about is a fixed amount of money. The amount that an individual can get out of the pot depends on a formula described in the settlement, right?
Described in the settlement
and
applied by the claims administrator.
And to the extent that someone said to be my client, get some of the money out of the pot, but is not entitled to it, necessarily everyone else who's entitled to get money out of the pot gets less.
You disagree with that?
We disagreed with that on the loss argument, which you didn't invite argument on. But as to restitution, I accept that as a starting point. And the point is that if anyone lost anything, it was those other members of the class. I'm not sure I understand your point about the class as a whole being a victim, because the class as a whole has the same pot of money.
Is the only entity who has the pot of money.
The pot of money.
Because the class is an entity that really forecloses the individuality of members of the class as they have been defined in the certification order. So they don't come into play until they've actually made the claims.
Okay.
So there's yes. really one person or entity that can be the entity that experiences a loss.
And to cut class. to the chase for purposes of this criminal appeal, that is not the entity to which restitution was ordered. Like any other criminal penalty, restitution is defined by statute and can only be awarded in strict accordance with the terms of the statute. The government invokes, in the opening line of this part of their brief, fundamental justice. That is not the standard. The standard well, is
restitution text. By proxy. Restitution by proxy, what we're dealing with here. Right.
So this was not a proxy situation where an entity that stands in for unknown individuals serves their purposes, serves like a charity.
But the restitution goes to the administrator, the claims administrator.
Right, who suffered
and
no
the
loss.
Claims administrator can then identify the individuals to whom the amounts correspond, correct?
That was the order that was entered, which is unlawful.
How was that unlawful?
Because the administrators to whom restitution was ordered to be paid is not a victim of the offense.
I was about to ask you, would you agree with me that the district court was wrong in saying that the claims administrators were victims?
Yes. Here? Yes. Yes. That's
just
exactly
administrators.
The point.
They are and then, only that.
And then just to make sure I'm answering Judge Restrepo fully, the court then directed the administrator and stated that it anticipated that the administrator would identify the class members whom the court believed had been underpaid and to direct any money received in restitution over to them, to identify them and send the money to them. There is nothing in the restitution statute that authorizes this kind of delegation scheme. It's not a proxy. The money is not going to the administrators in lieu of other victims because the administrator, the proxy, the alleged proxy serves their interests, protects their interests. That has been done in cases where it's kind of like a charity fraud and the money goes to the to the attorney general's nonprofit unit.
In describing this proxy theory, a proxy for whom?
Right.
I mean, I ask that because again, I know that the class is the entity, it's the only entity that really exists for the litigative purposes of this lawsuit and for the ultimate payout. So while we are eventually going to be looking at claimants who can make out that they have a claim for this amount because they qualify under the definition of the class as set forth in the certification order, that those determinations are going to be made by the administrator. You either fit into these or you don't fit into these. You're entitled to this amount, you're not entitled to this amount. But are you suggesting that there was no loss to the class such that the individual class members were not receiving as much as they would have but for the fraud of your client?
That's the finding that the district court made, and we didn't dispute it in this appeal. It was disputed at sentencing, but I have not disputed it on appeal. The dispute on appeal is that nothing in the statute authorizes this kind of multi-step process for distributing restitution to unidentified
I'm
next,
sure that,
downstream
I'm sure
victims.
It was not contemplated there is no that direct... you'd have a criminal proceeding that was somehow bumping into
right.
A class action.
But plenty of other ways this can be done and were done. The case was prosecuted civilly in parallel by the SEC. A large garnishment award was given. Disgorgement was awarded. And the disgorgement can be processed on the civil side. And Judge Kenney saw that it was the same money because he ordered that on the civil judgment that a credit be given for any money collected on the criminal side.
So then what do we do? Let's assume we agree with you. This was not done right. What do we do?
You vacate the restitution. It's an illegal sentence. No lawful restitution was ordered. The government.
There was no
remand for resentencing.
The government doesn't get a resentencing because they didn't advance a lawful theory at sentencing and the judge didn't order it.
So we vacate the sentencing and Mr. Camerota keeps the money?
No. He's been ordered to pay the same money two other ways, as a money judgment restitution and in garnishment to the SEC.
Well, the legal system is not going to
same money.
Wait a minute, please. The legal system is not going to allow a triple dipping.
The legal system would allow a double dipping. I'm sorry to say.
Excuse me?
So unfortunately, the legal system does allow a double dipping, but not a triple.
Well, the triple here, as I understand you argued it.
Yes.
In the SEC proceeding.
But they did proceed as to cover themselves in three ways. That's right. But
if we were to look at this as in a trust scenario, because the claims administrator really is holding money in trust.
Yes,
for the.
That's true.
You're saying that under the statute, the court could not award the money to go to the trust and allow the trustee then to make the individual, assuming that the claimants were the beneficiaries of the trust, the money could not be awarded to the trust and to allow the trustee to then figure out what beneficiaries are eligible for it.
If I understand correctly what Judge Smith was saying, I think that's another way of asking the same question. Right. It's a reverse of the prior case. If the government had sought it and if the district court had ordered it, perhaps restitution could have been ordered to the class. No one suggested that. It's not in any of the briefs. No one raised that. But the class is a kind of trust in your terminology for the investors who are members of the class and who don't opt out. But that wasn't done. What was done is unlawful, and it should be reversed.
That Judge struck the rest about. If you're giving the money to the class, why wouldn't the claims administrators serve as a proxy for the class?
They're not a proxy for the class. They're clerical functionaries.
But the functionary is to dole the money out to the people who are entitled to it.
Yeah,
but they have no fiduciary obligation. They're
I'll take your word
by
for
the
that.
Court.
Yeah.
As part of the settlement, but someone who is a fiduciary for the class is the judge who approved the settlement and presumably also certified the class. And that's the law of just about every circuit in the country, as far as I know.
And no such entity was sought or ordered restitution. So it should be vacated. It's illegal. And as it happens, no harm to the government, but it's unlawful and should be vacated.
You say no harm because the victims will be made whole.
Yes.
Civilly?
Through remission of the forfeiture or through the garnishment in the civil case, or both.
Maybe then you can get to the property, the Poconos property, which arguably would serve for at least part of the compensation as well. And you're saying that the seizure of the forfeiture of the Poconos property was improper.
Yes. So the way the Rule 32.2 works is the defendant is entitled to a jury trial on the nexus between specific items of property and the offense that authorizes restitution.
And identifiable at the time of the trial, right?
The rules leave open the prospect of after discovered property, right?
After trial.
Yeah, after.
I'm sorry. No, after sentencing.
After sentencing.
After what the rule says, what Rule E says, is evidence that for items, additional items that were located and identified after the order of forfeiture was entered. Mm-hmm. That means after sentencing. The rule does not address. Well, first of all, so you understand what happened at trial. Judge Kenney complied with the rule by saying, do we have anything on forfeiture that needs to go to the jury?
The sentencing judge must. So he didn't, nobody violated anything.
He didn't commit any error there. He didn't commit any error at trial, mm-hmm. when he asked the prosecutor, do we have anything about forfeiture that needs to go to the jury? And the prosecutor said no, meaning specifically said, we are not seeking the forfeiture of any
only,
specific
well, didn't he
item.
Say only money?
Only money. Only money. And at sentencing, the government changed its position and sought the forfeiture of this item of property.
Okay, but doesn't the record support their contention that they didn't know about it?
No.
That this was after discovery?
No, there is nothing in the record that supports that contention. That is an assertion that was made. It's a fact, purely factual assertion, was made for the first time in the appellate brief. And that is the essence of our of the second aspect of this argument.
Is the essence of your case on forfeiture that your client was denied a jury?
You're right.
As to the forfeiture?
Yes. Yes, a jury. Yes.
Because you make a statement.
As to this
the
item.
Judge is not a jury. Of course, you know, that's true. That's obvious.
But given McIntosh, it seems like there's a right there without a remedy. Given McIntosh, what happens in this scenario?
No, the remedy is that the item of specific property cannot be ordered to be forfeited.
Why don't we just remand to the sentencing court and have them proceed accordingly, as they, I think, would be permitted to do?
Because this court's cases in Dickler and Roe prohibit that.
How so?
That we do not give the government a second bite at the apple for having a better idea on appeal of a factual nature of what they wish to do about a sentencing error. They have to make their case. The defense lawyer made the right objection here, and the government responded without saying, we did not discover this property until whenever, and invoke some rule that would authorize the forfeiture to be made at that time in that way. And they brushed it off as not a violation of the rule, which clearly was. The judge ordered forfeiture in violation of the rule. The remedy is to vacate the forfeiture to the extent that it reaches the house as a specific item. If the government has some other way to get the house later if they need it,
they can do that.
They can.
Yeah.
They can, but they can't get this court in a criminal appeal to facilitate it. It's not part of this appeal. It's not part of this appeal if they have some substitute asset proceeding they want to invoke later in another way. They don't get to ask this court to administer the forfeiture in a way that they didn't ask for.
How does that benefit your client by allowing the government to proceed sometime down the road with a forfeiture proceeding rather than just having us remand with the limited purpose of giving you an opportunity, giving your client an opportunity to have a jury?
They may or may not be able to prove the tracing. They may or may not.
Well, that's why I'm saying they may or may not be able to establish. If you had a shot at another at a jury, once again, doesn't that remedy?
Oh no, there's no jury. There won't be a jury.
Okay.
None of the proceedings that might hypothetically happen in the future that the government invokes in their misguided version of harmless error.
I'm saying if we were to remand this case, since you wanted a jury in this case.
Remand the case for a jury trial on this issue?
As I said, I think we're talking past one another. You have said a judge is not a jury.
Right.
I asked you a while back if what was at the heart of this was that your client did not get a jury on the forfeiture of the real property issue, and you agreed with me. So I'm trying to figure out a way that we could cure that.
The error was not the overruling of a request for a jury at the time of trial. There was no request
for
a jury.
Well, there couldn't have been because nobody allegedly knew about the property.
We don't concede that. And there's nothing in...
I said allegedly.
Yeah. The only relevant evidence to that is the affidavit of the forensic examiner who traced the property, and there's nothing about dates or times. And I'm very doubtful that by the words located and identified after the order would apply to this house. The house was not located. They didn't misunderstand where the house was located. They didn't identify the house later. They knew the house existed. They just didn't get around to doing what it now in hindsight seems the rule required them to do.
So their big mistake was answering the question, we only want, or asserting to the trial court, we only want money. That was their error.
The error is the entry of an illegal order of forfeiture at sentencing. So our position is there was no error at trial.
That's based upon the statement that he just
the government waived the forfeiture of any item of property by saying we only want money.
How did they waive it?
By saying we only
that's what I just asked you about.
That's a waiver. That's a waiver. And they forfeited. They talk about waiver and forfeiture in appellate process. They waived the claim for the item of property by giving that answer at trial. And they forfeited this factual claim about, oh, we didn't know, we weren't able to do the tracing at the time, by not raising it at sentencing when the objection was made.
Couldn't they still proceed against the property under 853?
So they say.
Assuming that they can establish one of the five elements.
So if they can meet the statutory requirements, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. So when you ask what's in this for my client is compliance with the law. We want no sentence imposed on him that is unlawful.
And of course,
not forfeiture and not restitution.
Of course, his ex-wife, I think, gets more than he does out of that.
Well, company. There's a divorce settlement that says she gets 80%. There's a subsequent multi-party written agreement that was filed in the civil case and cross-filed in the criminal case in relation to the stay that modifies her rights somewhat. But yes. Yeah, but that's not part of this appeal. This appeal is simple. No sentence can be imposed that is not authorized by law. A restitution was imposed that is not authorized by law. Forfeiture was imposed that is not authorized by law. Those should be vacated.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Shapiro.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Paul Shapiro. I'm an assistant United States attorney, and I represent the United States in this case. I'm happy to start in either reverse order or forward order, whichever pleases the court.
Well, why is Mr. Goldberg wrong? It seems to me, well, first of all, what is the, quote, newly discovered evidence? Where is that in the record?
Sure. So, So you need to actually go back to the trial record, if you will give me a little bit of latitude to answer your question, I do need to step back and address the waiver question first because they're intimately related.
I'm not sure how you're going to get there, but I'm really just concerned with whether or not the representation that was just made is accurate, that there's nothing on the record to substantiate.
This
is newly discovered evidence.
Okay, and so the short answer is, it's the combination of the representations we made to the court at the time of trial with the submission of the declaration afterwards, along with the interchanges between the parties at the time, which is why I want to step back to that interchange. Mr. Goldberger says loud and long that the government waived. But when you go back to the trial record, we did nothing of the sort. We addressed a question about the presently existing state of facts. We answered it truthfully and completely and honestly and made no statement about our future intentions or rights. So if you go back to page 1802 of the record, the judge says, we can go on the record. So forfeiture, we already discussed. We don't need to do anything with that because it's not a notice of forfeiture as to specific property. In other words, the judge is addressing the notice in the indictment and is accurately stating, although the notice says specific property, it doesn't identify any because we didn't have any.
Why did it say specific property? Just to kind of cover yourself with paper and
well, the statute requires that if we are going to be asking for specific property, we say in the notice we're going to be asking for it. But then it tells us we don't have to identify what it is.
You're not required to state a specific amount of money. You're not required to identify a particular piece of property.
No, but we are required to say that we are going to ask for specific property if we ever are. So we do, and the notice did. So it was.
Then after that,
it's what you might call unspecific property.
Okay. But after that, weren't you more specifically asked by the judge, and you said no.
So no, and then So the judge says the notice of forfeiture does not identify any specific property. And my colleague says it's a money judgment only. So technically, actually addressing the words, he was affirming to the court that the notice is seeking a money judgment only. And more generally, what he was saying to the court was...
That is the kind of argument that only a lawyer could love.
but in the context, what we're saying to the court is we have nothing beyond a money judgment at this moment.
So when did the government find out about the Pocono house?
So we knew that the house existed, and we knew it belonged to Mr. Camerata.
Right. When did you know that?
Certainly by the time of the bail proceeding, very early on.
Really?
But we were not in a position to identify it as specific property until after the sentencing proceeding.
You said you knew the house existed, but you weren't in a position.
I don't understand that. Okay, so what is it we need? So what is it we need to do to identify something as specific property? We need to know that it exists, but we also need to know that it's tainted. In other words, if you look at the rule, if in that colloquy with the court we had said we're aware of the Pocono house, the judge would have said to us, okay, now by rule you have to provide the jury with evidence that it's tainted. We had no evidence. We were not aware of its tainted status. Not a big surprise. This is a case with millions and millions and millions of dollars of fraudulent proceeds, and a defendant who had, even before the fraud began, millions and millions of dollars. He had dozens of counts. He had assets distributed literally across the globe, in the United States, in Colombia, the country of Colombia, in the Bahamas. He had insurance policies in the names of others where he could use the property and he could lodge his property there. Even these many years later, there are daily dozens of emails relating to Mr. Camerata's property. It was a complicated, complex case. And the statute and the rules contemplate that in such circumstances, the government is to identify the specific property that it can then prove is tainted as of the time of sentencing. And we have every incentive to do that. Understand, it's in our interest to do that twofold. Number one, by identifying the property, we are able to prevent its dissipation. We're able to preserve it and prevent its dissipation. So we have every incentive to identify it early and often. We also have every incentive to have the issue tried by a jury if the jury is available. Because by definition, forfeiture issues get tried to the jury under one circumstance and one circumstance only, where the trial jury has already convicted the defendant of committing a crime that results in forfeiture. And they have convicted him beyond a reasonable doubt. So to say that it's a favorable forum for the government is an understatement. It's a glorious forum for us. So if we have the opportunity to identify specific property, it's in our interest to do so. And in many, many cases, of course, that happens.
You say identify. What you're really saying is taint.
Well, but identify is a term of art, because knowing that a piece of property exists doesn't tell you that it's subject to forfeiture under the statute.
What do we need
at least probable cause, right? Otherwise, we couldn't even get it included in the notice in the indictment. We need at least probable cause, if not as a matter of professional ethics, we couldn't proceed to present an issue to a jury where we didn't believe we had a preponderance of the evidence. So when the rule and the statute talk about identifying property, it's not, oh, we didn't know that the Pocono property existed. We knew it existed, but we had no evidence as of the time of our representation to the court that that property was subject to forfeiture as a tainted item. In other words, that it was the kind of thing that we were entitled to proceed on by way of identification and presentation to the jury.
So under the law, is Mr. Goldberger correct that somewhere down the road, you have an opportunity to proceed with a forfeiture of this real property?
Yes.
We vacated this part of the sentence.
Except that vacating would be, we did nothing wrong and the court did nothing wrong here. Because by the time of sentencing, we were aware of the existence of the property and its of its tainted status. And under the statute, we are to, the statute actually deals with that circumstance somewhat directly and implicitly. What the statute says is if at the time of sentencing, the government cannot identify all the specific property that it might want, the court is to enter a general order that identifies the specific property that is subject to forfeiture as tainted, and then generally allows the government to come back. And that's exactly what was done here. As of the time of sentencing, we knew about the tainted status of the Pocono property, so it was included in the preliminary order of forfeiture that was presented. Now, and the defendants claim that, oh, I lost a jury trial right. That is not accurate. There is a jury trial right by rule, not by constitution, but by rule. But it's a right that is very limited. It is limited. Essentially, what it is there are competing interests. And the rule, right, the Supreme Court had already told us it's a non-constitutional, you don't have a jury trial right to determine any aspect of your sentence, including forfeiture. And so when the authors of the rule decided that if there was a jury available and if it would not interfere with the primary objective of forfeiture, which is to separate the wrongdoer from his ill-gotten gains, then let's use the jury that's there. But if it is inconvenient, if it interferes with that primary purpose, then we do it with a judge and not a jury. And so if by the conclusion of the trial proceeding, we have identified a specific property as tainted, the jury gets to decide it if either party requests, right? We have that same right too. And as I pointed out, we would be inclined to avail ourselves of that because it's a very friendly form. But if neither party wants it, then the judge decides it and the judge decides it later. And that can come up either because nobody wants a jury or because the property is not yet identified in the sense of knowing of its existence and knowing of its connection to the defendant's offense. So here that knowledge came to our attention after trial and before sentencing. And so we did what the rule requires us to do. And I would point out to you the idea that our investigation had not yet turned up the Pocono property as of the time of the end of the trial. That's not dereliction. That's not improper. Indeed, if you look at the advisory committee notes to the rule 32.2, they specifically point out that they contemplate that a government's financial investigation might not actually begin until the conviction. Now, as I say, we have incentives to do it early, but there are lots of investigations and lots of cases, and this case involved many, many, many assets with money moving in and out, some of it clean, some of it dirty. And so the process of identifying would start with the most important assets and would ultimately arrive at the ones that are less important. In this case, by the time the analyst got to the house, it was post-trial pre-sentencing. And so it was included as it should have been in the preliminary notice of forfeiture.
What about the claims administrator in the statute?
Okay. So, as I say, my view is there was no waiver and the proceedings went as they should have. With regard to restitution, it's a bad policy, but I'd like to start by quibbling with Judge Smith a little bit.
I do it all the time.
Go right ahead.
It generally works better.
Let's hope that you have a better chance of being right than he.
I would be satisfied with having the same chance of being right as Judge McKee. So, your concept is absolutely correct.
I'm pretty confident of that, having taught class actions for 15 years.
But the victim here is not really the class itself, because the class includes people who actually are not among the people who are going to get
No, it paid. Doesn't. Then they're not class
members. Yeah, just by definition.
That's right, a contradiction in terms.
Well, the settlement fund, the approved claimants to the settlement fund all have to be members of the class, but not all members of the class are approved members of the settlement fund.
Then they shouldn't have been members of the class in the first place.
Well, no, but
that has to be a downstream administrative determination made. They have to meet the requirements of what a class member is to be pursuant to the certification order.
I absolutely agree with that. Maybe it's a terminology issue. I'm trying to be very, very careful. If you think about not a week goes by that I don't get something in the mail that tells me that I'm a member of the class. And if I bought the stock during the relevant time and I suffered the relevant loss, I am a member of the class, but I'm only entitled to compensation if I go through the steps that are necessary.
Well, sure, that's true. But if you don't, it doesn't make you any less a member of the class until the period of time is over for you to have made a claim. At that point, you have no right to it. You've forfeited any right to be a member of the class.
In my view, I'm still a member of the class. I'm just not entitled to any money.
No, you're not entitled to any money by the terms of what I would think are most or all settlement agreements. Certainly.
Right. So let's sort of I can adopt your language or we can adopt neutral language, which is you have a group of people who are members of the class who have qualified to receive settlement funds. And whether
who was defrauded here?
The persons who are qualified to be class members who were also qualified to receive funds from the settlements.
So downstream, they would experience some loss, some lesser amount.
Correct.
But at the time of the fraudulent activity, to whom were the claims of the victims here, or the defendants here, made?
They were made to the funds, right?
They were made to the funds, which were simply an adjunct of the class. The class still existed at that time.
Or they were the subject of court order, right? It was a court-administered fund in each case. And if you look at, and Mr. Goldberger has elided the actual language of the restitution order.
And actually, can you tell me how it would disadvantage you if we were to determine that, in fact, it was the class that was defrauded here and experienced the loss for sentencing guideline purposes?
Not, as Your Honor is using the term, not at all, because that's who the restitution was made payable to. Mm-hmm. The judge actually ordered restitution to the settlement funds, which I think is another word for the term that Your Honor is using, which is the class. The judge didn't make it payable to the claims administrator. The judge made it payable to the settlement funds for the administrator then to take those funds and distribute them in turn to those who were eligible to receive them at the time of the initial distribution or distributions. So it isn't that the judge made a mistake and classified the administrator as the victim and made the restitution payable in favor of the administrator. He absolutely did not. If you actually look at the judgment itself, which I think is at appendix pages 2 and following, the restitution is victim funds, FUNDS, as outlined in the attachment on restitution. And if you look at the attachment on restitution, it lists a series. The very first column is entitled fund, and it has the name of the fund as a result of the particular court settlement. And then it identifies the administrator who's administrating it. And it's very similar. Imagine that it was a decedent's estate, that a person died and they had a will and there was $1 million in the estate, and Mr. Camerata pilfered $500,000 of it. The court would order Mr. Camerata to return the $500,000, not to the beneficiaries.
I'm sure that's correct. But again, it's not what we have here, which is a pretty much a unique situation, at least it's unique in my experience, where we have this convergence of criminal restitution because a class itself was defrauded, which meant money to which class members were ultimately entitled had been taken wrongfully.
True, but it was taken out of a pool that was going to be distributed. And so the judge's order says, put it back in the pool. You took the money out of the pool. You made the water level in the pool drop. Put the water back.
Yeah.
And then the pool goes back up and the new water gets distributed the way.
So how is defining the entity or party or victim here as the class impacted in any way by that? I mean, the money goes back. I agree with you. It goes back to the class, meaning it goes back to the fund that is a function of the settlement between the parties.
And that's what Judge Kenney ordered. That is actually literally what he ordered.
Well, he also called the administrators victims, which can't be correct.
They were lied to. They were lied to.
They were not monetary victims here.
They probably were not monetary victims, but the judge made it very clear that the victims that were getting restitution in this case.
If I've been lied to, I don't consider myself a victim unless I'm stupid enough to have believed the lie.
Which they did, which of course they did to the tune of $40 million. And look, the administrators themselves may have been financial consequences because they may have borne some liability, but they didn't get any restitution. The restitution doesn't go to the administrators under the order. The restitution goes to the settlement funds.
The administrators are paid otherwise.
It's
for the function that they serve.
In the exact same way that a decedent's estate were defrauded, the money would go back to the estate and the administrator of the estate would parcel the money out. It's exactly the same. I also want to correct something that Mr. Goldberger said, which is he said, it doesn't really matter what you do because these victims are all going to get paid in the civil case. Not true. The SEC has cabined its own financial damages only to the money that the SEC was going to get and has given the defendant credit up front for all of the restitution payments. So if the restitution payments go away, the civil judgment does these victims absolutely no good. And under the law, of course, the government is entitled, the victims are entitled to their restitution and the government is entitled to its forfeiture both. And what Mr. Goldberger is suggesting is that despite the fact that his client made off with $40 million, that there should be no restitution owed, and if the government wants to qualify victims for forfeiture funds, of course, one of the requirements to qualify victims for recompense under forfeiture funds is that they be victims under a court's restitution order. So essentially what Mr. Goldberger is saying is that this $40 million goes back to Joe Camerata and not to the victims. In the government's view, the forfeiture order was entirely appropriate. If you actually look at the order and look at what Judge Kenney did, the people, the ultimate victims, the class members, as Your Honor suggests, actually suffered two losses. They suffered the initial loss as a result of the securities fraud, and then they had their compensation for that first loss hijacked by the defendant. And those two sets of losses are distinct from one another. It's like if my house were the subject of arson and the insurance company came and sent me a check for $100,000 to rebuild the house, and Mr. Camerata pilfered the check from my mailbox and cashed it, the judge would say to him, give Shapiro a check for $100,000. He couldn't defend on the grounds that, well, the insurance company was too generous. He Shapiro only suffered $75,000. No, I suffered $100,000 because I was getting $100,000. In this case, the claimants in the fund had been approved for settlements, which represented a portion of the $40 million. The defendant took that away, reduced the amount that they would have gotten, and Judge Kenney said, put it back. And the administrators will distribute that to the people who would have gotten it in the first place. That's entirely what the restitution statute is designed to accomplish. Thank you.
Thank you.
If I may, I'd like to talk about the forfeiture. We'll stand on my argument with respect to the restitution, which did not comply with the statute.
I didn't hear what you said. I didn't hear what you just said. I'm sorry.
I'm standing on my argument that the restitution did not comply with the with any provision of the restitution statute. However, it could be logically justified in some other way. But I would like to talk in the time I have in rebuttal about the forfeiture, because the government is making a kind of a shocking argument. The government says, we knew about the house. We knew about the money. We knew about the bank accounts. We had all the bank accounts. We can deprive not just Joe Camerota, but any defendant at any time at will of the very limited right that a defendant has under B5 to a jury trial under these circumstances by choosing not to have a government agent read the bank records. And so if we haven't satisfied ourselves that we can satisfy our tracing obligation, in effect, by choosing not to prepare for trial, we can defer this issue that is to be decided at trial to the defendant's benefit with a jury in to some later stage where the defendant doesn't get a jury. They had the bank records, and I'm accepting as fact all these facts which are not in the record that my friend Mr. Shapiro has articulated, that they, when they just knew about the house, when they knew about the records, blah, 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 all of that. I accept that as true. It shows they're wrong. They chose not to prepare, and then they're using their lack of preparation as a defense. That can't be right. It's not a plausible reading of B5 and E of Rule 32.2 together. And I think the words of 32.2E show that can't be right, because it talks about property that the government discovered, it's not the word they use, but discovered after the order was entered. That means after sentencing. The government has no such leeway in the time between trial and sentencing under the terms of the rule. And the benefit to the defendant of a jury is what we heard, that Mr. Camerota had plentiful other untainted assets. A jury would not have had to agree. May I finish this thought? A jury would not have had to agree with the last in, first out hypothesis of the government's hired forensic examiner that they used for sentencing. They could have said that this couple had plenty of money to buy this house, and we're not persuaded that any of the money from the fraud that we just convicted him of went into the house. The government hasn't shown it by whatever burden they would have at this jury trial. And for the government to say, well, the jury trial their argument makes the very limited right to jury trial that the defense function, the defense interest fought tooth and nail over the wording of 32.2 when it was created in Rule 2000 to preserve some right to jury trial. And the government now has a theory to negate that right entirely by relying on their own choice not to prepare for trial and to be negligent. This right, this claim was waived at trial, forfeited at sentencing, and this forfeiture should be vacated.
Thank you.